This is Ham College, episode 135, for February 27th, 2026. Ham College is brought to you by ICOM. Whether the bands are calm, crowded, or somewhere in between, when the gear stays out of your way and the contacts keep coming, you know you're in good company. Choose ICOM. I'm Professor Thomas.
And I'm Dean Martin.
And welcome to another exciting episode of Ham College. We've got questions for the amateur technician exam tonight.
Plenty of them?
Yeah, probably just over 20 of them. What did we talk about last time around?
Let me check my memory here. Seems like it was about maybe antennas, transmission line measurements, and troubleshooting. Measuring SWR, effects of high SWR, causes of feed line failures, basic coax cable characteristics, and the use of dummy loads when testing. That was in the first part. Then we went on to another part, I think, if I remember correctly, part about using basic test instruments, voltmeters, ammeters, ohmmeters, and soldering.
Yeah, okay.
That's just off the top of my head.
That's what we're going to talk about tonight.
Oh, okay. That sounds like a good idea. I'm just having deja vu.
Last month, we talked about station equipment, receivers, transceivers, transmitters, amplifiers, receive amplifiers, transverters, basic radio circuit concepts, and terminology, sensitivity, selectivity, mixers, oscillators, PTT, and modulation. And as if that wasn't enough, we covered symptoms, causes, and cures of common transmitter and receiver problems, overload and overdrive, distortion, interference, and consumer electronics, and RF feedback.
What's the primary purpose of a dummy load? A, to prevent transmitting signals over the air when making tests.
B, to prevent overmodulation of a transmitter.
C, to improve the efficiency of an antenna.
Or D, to improve the signal-to-noise ratio of a receiver. What is the primary purpose of a dummy load? Well, you know, just right off, I think I'll just go straight for the answer. I think probably most people can guess this one here. I'm going to say it's A, to prevent transmitting signals over the air when making tests.
Well, I would concur with that.
That's what the chat room is saying, except for email, and he's saying, hey. What's that?
He's speaking Louisianese.
Yep. Hey, it is to prevent transmitting signals over the air when making tests. I do it often.
Yep. Me too.
Which of the following is used to determine if an antenna is resonant at the desired operating frequency? A VTVM, which is stands for vacuum tube voltmeter.
A B, an antenna analyzer.
C, a Q meter.
Or D, a frequency counter. Which of the following is used to determine if an antenna is resonant at a desired frequency, operating frequency? A frequency counter is not going to do that. That's going to measure the frequency of a transmitter. A Q meter, nope. It's going to be B, I think. But I don't think a vacuum tube voltmeter is going to help you there either. So it's got to be B, an antenna analyzer. I use one often, so I'm pretty sure that's the answer.
Yeah. That's what they're saying in the chat room. I'm agreeing with you on that one. And it is an antenna analyzer. Here's one right here. This is a Rig Expert brand. Here's an MFJ one. The MFJ made a lot of them. They probably sold more than anybody else over the years, particularly early on. You got a Nano VNA?
Yep. Basically the same thing and then more.
Yeah. More than just an antenna analyzer.
It will do that.
Yeah. I don't have one of those. I only have three or four assorted antenna analyzers.
What does a dummy load consist of? A, A high gain amplifier and a TR switch.
B, a non-inductive resistor mounted on a heat sink.
C, a low voltage power supply and a DC relay.
Or D, a 50 ohm reactance used to terminate the transmission line. What does a dummy load consist of? Well, I mean, just calling it a dummy load, you know it's not much.
It's not going to be smart.
No. It's not a high gain amplifier and a TR switch, a transmit or receive switch. Let's see, a 50 ohm reactance used to terminate a transmission line. That almost sounds correct, but it would be a 50 ohm resistance if that's what you were using it for, not a reactance for sure. C, a low voltage power supply and a DC relay. Nah. B, a non-inductive resistor mounted to a heat sink. There's your answer. There you go. And I just happen to have a non-inductive resistor right here mounted on a heat sink with a PL259 on the end. Or that's an adapter. You can unscrew it and it's a type N. This one is a Decibel Products or DB Products 50 ohm, 25 watt dummy load. It's a good little dummy load if all you need is 25 watts.
Yeah.
I've got some others as well. Some higher
one. An MFJ version of that over there hanging on my workbench.
Yeah. I've got a number of different and various dummy loads around here, all different powers. This is the closest one I could grab since I didn't do it before the show tonight.
Yeah. Some of them are actually like a paint can with mineral oil in it, too, for the heat sink.
And,
that's the high-power ones.
Exactly what it is. And I almost wanted one of those, except I've got a couple of others that will do the wattage that it will. So never went that route, but lots of those are still around. What reading on an SWR meter indicates a perfect impedance match between the antenna and the feed line? A, 50 to 50.
B, 0.
C, 1 to 1.
Or D, full scale. And I think that's one thing you don't want to be full scale on. If you have full scale SWR, you got a dead short somewhere.
Yeah.
A really bad problem. 50-50 is not too good either, and zero means you got no output power whatsoever, I'm thinking. So I'm going to go with C, Charlie, 1-to-1. That means what you're sending out is not getting reflected back, so basically you got it up, all your power's going out the antenna.
Yep.
Not coming back to the transmitter.
I'll agree with you.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Chat room agrees with you.
They are agreeable tonight.
They are.
Why do most solid-state transmitters reduce output power as SWR increases beyond a certain level? A, to protect the output amplifier transistors.
B, to comply with FCC rules on spectral purity.
C, because power supplies cannot supply enough current at high SWR.
Or D, to lower the SWR on the transmission line. Why do most solid-state transmitters reduce output power as SWR increases beyond a certain level? To lower SWR on the transmission line. No, you would lower reflected power if you decreased the forward power, but you wouldn't change the SWR, the standing wave ratio. It would still be the same ratio. C, because power supplies cannot supply enough current at high SWR. If they could, well, I think they can, but you wouldn't want higher current just so you could run high SWR. It's just going to burn up something. B, to comply with FCC rules on spectral purity. I don't know about that one. If you did have a high SWR, Maybe some solid-state amplifiers might not be quite as spectrally pure, but definitely to protect the output amplifier transistors, you don't want to burn those up. And if you're running them into an improper load, you know, that's what's going to happen if it doesn't automatically turn itself down. A. They're saying A in the chat room. Yes, we do need to
find. Vanille says LOL.
Yeah. And we do need to find a Canadian emoji for A. We could use it a lot.
Yep. Hey, you know, before we get much farther, I got a good job for the professor.
Oh?
All this SWR talk. So SWR is for standing wave ratio, but what does that actually mean? Why would it burn anything up if you had a high one?
Well, if you had a one-to-one, let's say, and you had 100 watts of power, when you keyed up, if it's one-to-one VSWR or SWR, same, we're talking about the same thing there. One-to-one means 100% of what you're sending out is going out the antenna. If you had a higher number as a second number, in other words, like a 1 to 5, that means you're going to have, and I hesitate to say exactly how much, but you're going to have a high reflected power. At 1 to 5, you can get by with. If you get to something like 2 to 1, that's getting really bad. If you're putting 100 watts out, you're going to have a lot of power that's returned. It couldn't go out the antenna. It was reflected back down the transmission line, back into your transmitter. And that's just going to cause it to heat up, be inefficient, and possibly burn up. You know? So, yeah. You want 1 to 1 so you can get all that power out the antenna.
Right. It's thought that might be a good explanation for some of the people that weren't familiar with exactly what SWR was.
Yeah.
Because this is a technician.
Yeah. And, cool. Well, since you're so inquisitive about SWR there, maybe you know the answer to this.
I had to open my mouth, didn't I?
Yeah. What does an SWR reading of 4 to 1 indicate? A, loss of minus 4 dB.
B, good impedance match.
C, gain of plus 4 dB.
Or D, impedance mismatch. I don't know that it's a loss of 4 dB, and it's not a good impedance match for sure. Because we just said 1 to 1's best, right?
Right.
And it's not going to be a gain either of dB. It's going to be D, impedance mismatch. The only thing that makes any sense.
Yep. I'll agree with you. Chat room, yeah, they're all saying D.
What happens to power lost in a feed line? A, it increases the SWR.
B, it is radiated as harmonics.
C, it's converted into heat.
Or D, it distorts the signal. What happens to power lost in a feed line? Well, if it's lost in a feed line, that doesn't mean necessarily it's reflected back. It's just lost there. So it wouldn't necessarily increase the SWR. It is not radiated out as harmonics. I don't think it would distort the signal, but yeah, it would be C. It's converted into heat because that's what happens with loss. It's got to go somewhere. So you reach out there and that transmission line's hot, you're wasting some power.
A lot of it, I imagine.
Yeah.
It's hot.
Yeah. I mean, some of the broadcast transmitters, it's typical that there's some heat on there. It's not good, but it's there on some of the higher power ones. It's converted into heat. That's what they were saying over in the chat room.
Yep. I agree.
Yeah, you know, because really anything that's got loss in electronics, loss is going to be heat.
It's got to go somewhere,
gotta,
right?
Yeah.
So it turns into heat.
And that's why these switching power supplies and all are so efficient, because, you know, it's, none of it's wasted in heat. Which instrument can be used to determine SWR? A, a voltmeter.
B, ohmmeter.
C, iambic pent. I have to look at that one harder.
Iambic pentameter?
Yeah, iambic pentameter.
Or D, directional wattmeter. Well, it's not voltmeter. And it's not an ohmmeter. I have no idea what an iambic pentameter is. So I'm going with D, directional wattmeter.
Okay. I'm going to agree with you. A directional wattmeter. They're saying D over in the chat room. And it is. Here we go. A directional wattmeter. This one, unlike most of the birds, this particular one has an adjustable switch here, like 15, 50, 150, 500, or 1500. What that means is full scale. Like if it's on the 15 scale here, we can measure up to 15 watts on the bottom row there where you see 15. If we put it on 150, well, you're on the 150 watt scale. This, though, is the key. This is what makes it directional. This is a slug, and I can't take it out because this one's fixed in there. On most of the bird meters, you can swap it out. But since this watt meter has the range switches on it here, you don't take it out on this one. This particular one is good for 25 to 1,000 megahertz. So it'll cover a good bit of stuff. And it's 1500 watt. Yeah, 1500 watt element. So there's a connector on either side. One side you put your transmitter in, the other side you'll hook your antenna or your dummy load or whatever, you know, you're feeding power into. If this arrow is turned in that direction, then what you're measuring is forward power. Power going from the transmitter to the antenna. If you take that and switch it around, now what you're going to read on the meter is going to be the reflected power. In other words, it's a power that's gone through and reflected back into the meter. So with those two readings, you could calculate your SWR if you knew the forward and reflected. But basically, all you need to know is you got a certain amount of forward power. Flip it back. You want as little reflected power as possible. That's a directional watt meter.
Interesting.
Yep.
So do the bird ones, does the slug, you flip the slug around like that on the birds too?
Yes. Yep.
I've seen them, but I've never had one. I've never used one.
Yeah, on a bird, most of the birds are, I mean, this thing right here is basically a copy of a bird. It's a different brand. But yeah, you can get different slugs with different wattages. And in a bird, you just swap it out with a different wattage. Coaxial dynamics are the same way. This is a little unusual that this one actually has a range switch. There is a model of bird watt meter that has a range switch, though. Yeah.
But the bird ones, you can get different frequency band, different bands too, right? Different frequency ranges and watt ranges?
Yes, and the same thing on the coaxial dynamics. You can get different frequency ranges and wattages for them as well. Basically, this slug in this one would work in a bird brand meter, too. It may not be calibrated 100% right, but...
Oh, they said it couldn't come out.
Well, if I unscrewed this screw, it can. I'm not going to do it.
It's just not made to just to pull
yeah,
out.
Yeah, because you don't need to pull this one out, you know, because you got a range switch. So, and it's so broad, like 25 megahertz to 1,000 megahertz. That's going to cover, it's going to cover what I was using it for sure.
There's a question in the chat while you're waiting for the lights to come back on.
Yeah.
What's the advantage or disadvantage between a watt meter and SWR?
Yeah, a watt meter is what we just looked at. It measures wattage. You measure the forward wattage and the reflected wattage on it. An SWR meter is measuring both of those, but essentially what it's displaying is a ratio between the two. Between the forward and a reflected power.
Does calculation for you, basically.
Right. What is an iambic pentameter, Tom?
It's up there.
Is it? What was it? It's probably the most prevalent, widely used meter in classic English poetry. Okay. all right. Ben, I'm not a poet. I can't argue with that.
Which of the following causes failure of coaxial cables? A, moisture contamination.
B, solder flux contamination.
C, rapid fluctuation in transmitter output power.
RD, operation at 100% duty cycle for an extended period.
Ooh, I know this one.
Which of the following causes failure of coaxial cables? Well, let's go over the wrong ones first. We'll start at the bottom. D, operation at 100% duty cycle for an extended period. If that caused your coaxial cable to fail, you aren't using big enough cable. you know, as simple as that. That's on you. C, rapid fluctuations in transmitter output power. No, because AM and sideband are going to have rapid fluctuations in the output power. So no. B.
I see comments on D for that one, too. You're using the wrong cable.
Yep. B, solder flux contamination. Well, now that doesn't really cause it to fail unless maybe you use like acid core solder, maybe that could corrode the cable, but it's the biggie there is going to be a moisture contamination. If you get moisture in that cable, you probably should just throw it away. Once they've had moisture in it, it's never the same.
Yep. Squirrels cause failure of it too, trust me, firsthand experience.
Yep, well, they let moisture in.
Of course,
they
cause moisture to get in after they chewed the jacket up.
Yep. That could be squirrel spit in your cable.
Could be.
Well, let's see if we're right. Yeah, it's A, and that's what they were saying in the chat room. Okay. Why should the outer jacket of coaxial cable be resistant to ultraviolet light? A, ultraviolet-resistant jackets prevent harmonic radiation.
B, ultraviolet light can increase losses in the cable's jacket.
C, ultraviolet and RF signals can mix, causing interference.
Or D, ultraviolet light can damage the jacket, allow water to enter the cable. Why should the outer jacket of coax cable be resistant to ultraviolet light? Ultraviolet light resistant jackets prevent harmonic radiation? Nope, not A. Ultraviolet light can increase loss in the jacket? Nope. RF signals, nope. Going with D. Seen it happen with other things, not with my coax cable jacket though. But RF light can damage the jacket and allow water to enter the cable. So I'm going with D for that.
D, that's what they're saying in the chat.
I'm going to see if I'm right, then I have a comment.
You are right. Okay. Here.
I do it wrong. I'll cut my hand off. Your hands are so tiny, man.
You just pull back a nub there. Yeah, they are. It is kind of small, isn't it?
What is a disadvantage of air core coax cable when compared to foam or solid dielectric type? A, it has more loss per foot.
B, it cannot be used for VHF or UHF antennas.
C, it requires special techniques to prevent moisture in the cable.
Or D, it cannot be used at below freezing temperatures. What is the disadvantage of air core coaxial cable when compared to foam or solid dielectric types?
I think A, I might actually know this one. Maybe.
A, it has more loss per foot. No, quite the contrary. It has less loss per foot. If it's an air core, less loss in it. B, it cannot be used for VHF or UHF antennas. Nope, it can be used for those. And as a matter of fact, it's great for those because it has less loss than coaxial, typical, you know, coax would have at VHF and really at UHF frequencies. D, it cannot be used at below freezing temperatures. That's false, unless you had water in it. And if you got water in it, you can't really be using it anyway. So it is C. It requires special techniques to prevent moisture in the cable. That's the answer. It looks like everybody got it in the chat room. Yeah, and most hams don't really use that. It is used a lot in broadcasting. The reason we use it is because we've got such long runs of transmission line that we can run a higher power through the cable and have less loss. For, you know, a long distance. So if you're going up a 1,000-foot tower, 1,000-foot of coax or solid dielectric would have a lot of loss in it. The air dielectrics have a lot less. And, you know, there are charts for different types of coaxial cable, heliax, rigid transmission lines, coax, and they vary with frequency. The higher you go in frequency, the more loss is going to be in that cable. So when you get up to, you know, higher frequencies, it's not as big a deal, you know, really on HF. It's not a super big deal on VHF, although it starts having an effect if you got loss of cable. But UHF, yeah, but I don't know any hams that are using air dielectric cable. On the broadcast stations, we have generally a big tank of nitrogen sitting over there with a low-pressure regulator on it, putting a few pounds of pressure on that line all the time in the dielectric. Since it's air, we keep the nitrogen in there, and that keeps it dried out so that it doesn't have moisture build up and doesn't arc. You can also use a dehydrator, which is sort of an air compressor type apparatus that actually dries the moisture out of the air and pumps that into the transmission line. It runs, you know, maybe 4 or 5 pounds of pressure into the transmission line. All you need is just enough pressure of something dry, either nitrogen or dry air in there, so that you've got a little pressure on it. If you lose that pressure, what's going to happen is that moisture is then going to be sucked into the line through any cracks that are in it. And, you know, with temperature changing and stuff on, say, a long piece of copper, you could have condensation in there in that air dielectric, and this just helps keep it dried out. It's real common in broadcast and higher power
Seems
uses.
Seems like a dehydrator probably wouldn't be a great idea around here where it's so humid.
That works.
You probably work yourself to death.
Unless you've got a leak in your transmission line or your antenna. As a matter of fact, I'm only using dehydrators now. We were using nitrogen bottles when I started this particular group. But the problem you got there is you go off and leave and the nitrogen bottle empties out. You don't have any pressure on there. So,
yeah.
And if you got the dehydrator on there, It doesn't have to run all the time. None of my transmission lines are really very leaky. And so the dehydrator might run like 30 minutes a day. So it doesn't run that often. If you had a leak in it, though, yeah, you're right. It could sit there and run constantly, and it'd burn itself up. Well, that's all that group of questions. Looked like everybody passed over in the chat room, and we did too. We got more. Wow. Well, what do you say we take a quick break, come right back, and I don't know, you want to give away anything?
Yeah, how about I got a shirt over here we can give away.
Okay.
It's a cool shirt, too. People somehow like it.
Well, don't go away.
Stick around any ham radio conversation, and ICOM is bound to come up. The reason is straightforward: solid receivers, clear audio, and a layout that feels natural the second you start operating. These radios are made for real on the air time, whether the bands are calm, crowded, or somewhere in between. When the gear stays out of your way and the contacts keep coming, you know you're in good company. Choose ICOM. Remote ready, contest capable, and built for serious signal, step into the future of amateur radio with ICOM's powerhouse trio. The IC7760 HF 50 MHz digital transceiver, the ICPW2 1KW HF 50 MHz linear amplifier, and the all-new RC7760 remote controller. Designed to work in perfect harmony, this system offers full remote operation, high output performance, and seamless integration across the bands. The RC7760 remote control serves as an extra control head, and up to five can be registered to the RF deck, though only one can be active at a time. For wireless connectivity, simply connect a commercially available Wi-Fi access point via the LAN port. Whether you're working from the shack, the field, or a remote site, you'll experience crystal clear audio, digital precision, and amplifier-grade power, all from a single unified interface. It's the ideal setup for contesters, MCOM operators, and high-demand users who expect more from their gear. Together, they redefine what's possible in amateur radio, setting a new standard for global connectivity and reliability. The IC7300 MK2 builds upon everything operators loved about the original IC7300, elevating it to a sharper, cleaner, and more capable HF experience. Its improved RMDR, lower phase noise, enhanced cooling, and expanded I/O options make it the next level performer for serious operators who want crystal clear reception, rock solid transmit quality, and modern conveniences that fit today's operating styles. Also, check out Sirius Performance for Sirius operators with the IC9700 VHF UHF 1.2 GHz all-mode transceiver. For more information about ICOM's great amateur radios, contact icomamerica.com/amateur today.
If you needed some more Drobe, and why wouldn't you? We've got a great answer for you on how you could get some. All you need to do is send an email to hamcollege@amateurlogic.tv and register to win an ICOM t-shirt. You don't
like this?
Like that, yes.
Like ICOM Ham Crew t-shirt. Looked just as good when you leave in the Ham Fest as you did when you got there.
Yep.
Like I literally always say.
That one has literally less wrinkles than the one that's been over here in the cabinet for several years.
Yeah, this one's been hanging up in my closet for several years. Of course, I wear it on the show quite often, but it's a great shirt. I like it.
Yeah.
Can't go wrong with it. How'd you say you can get one?
Well, you just send an email to hamcollege@amateurlogic.tv. You don't have to put anything in the message. Basically, all you need is a name and an email address. It's nice if you put a little message in there to us, and this month's winner did. He said, "Hello, I enjoy reviewing test questions and explanations on your YouTube channel. Thanks, Jack Sensa."
Awesome. Congratulations, Jack.
Congratulations.
I can be getting in touch with you, and we'll get the shirt shipped out to you. So if you'd like to win an ICOM swag shirt, I don't know why you wouldn't, just drop us an email. Someone's going to win it, and might as well be you. What instrument would you use to measure electric potential? A, an ammeter.
B, a voltmeter.
C, a wave meter.
Or D, an ohm meter. Electric potential. A, an ammeter. That's going to measure amperage. Voltmeter is going to measure voltage, which I think is going to be considered electric potential. So it's not a wave meter. I don't even know what a wave meter is. And it's not an ohm meter. So I'm going with B, a voltmeter.
I'm going to agree with you. It is a voltmeter. The chat room, a little mixed on no, yes, no. Most of them are saying B, a voltmeter. And just so happens, I just looked it up on Wikipedia real quick because I thought the explanation there would be correct. Voltage, also known as electrical potential difference, electric pressure, or electric tension, is a difference in electric potential between two points and a static electric field. It corresponds to the work needed per unit of charge to move a positive test voltage from the first point to the second point in the international systems of units. The derived unit for voltage is the volt. Okay, I can see...
Whatever that means.
There's going to be a fight going on over that description there, because they're saying it's the corresponds to work needed per unit of charge to move a positive test charge from the first point to the second point.
Yeah, I remember the conversation we had a couple months back.
Yeah, when I was in school, we did not move positive charges. We moved negative charges. And I'm not sure what the current school of thought is, but yeah. There you go. It's
moving something.
Electric potential was right there. And that's what you just answered, electric potential. And that's because there's a voltage there. It's electricity, but it's just a potential. Unless it's connected to something and something's drawing current, it's just potential energy.
How is a voltmeter connected to a component to measure applied voltage? In series?
B, in parallel.
C, in quadrature.
Or D, in phase. How is a voltmeter connected to a component to measure applied voltage? Well, there's only one way to connect a voltmeter if you want to measure the applied voltage, and that's to connect it in parallel across the load. So let's say you got a resistor going across here. You put your voltmeter on either side of it. You put it in parallel with it, and that would tell you your voltage. Chat room, they're saying B, in parallel. All right, since you asked me that one, I'm going to come back at you.
Okay.
And
bring it on.
We're gonna step it up here, and it's going to be a fight between series and parallel. When configured to measure current, how is a multimeter connected to a component? A, in series.
B, in parallel.
C, in quadrature.
Or D, in phase. Configured to measure current. Oh, I know that one. No, I think I do. That's going to be in series, A, to measure current.
I'll agree with you.
I don't even know how to rule the other ones out. I just know that's how you hook it up to measure current.
Yep. You are correct. Chat room says so. And it is in series. So you got your electrical line going across there to whatever your load is. You just break that line and hook the meter across the break, and you're measuring all the current that's flowing through that circuit.
Which instrument is used to measure electric current? A, an ohmmeter.
B, an electrometer.
C, a voltmeter.
Or D, an ammeter. Which instrument is used to measure electrical current? Well, let's see. Current is measured in amps. So I'm going to say it's D, an ammeter. There's variations to these measurements, but the basics, yeah, voltages in parallel, currents in series. Which of the following can damage a multimeter? A, attempting to measure resistance using the voltage setting.
B, failing to connect one of the probes to ground.
C, attempting to measure voltage when using the resistance setting.
Or D, not allowing it to warm up properly. A multimeter doesn't have a warm-up cycle, so that's not going to be D.
The old vacuum T voltmeters had a warm-up cycle.
Well, I don't have one of those.
I don't know anybody. Well, somebody's got one, but not me.
Attempting to measure voltage when using a resistance setting. That could be something to that. Failing to connect one of the probes to ground or attempting to measure resistance using the voltage setting. I'm going to go with C, attempting to measure voltage when using the resistance setting.
That's what they're saying in the chat room. I agree. That was one of the first things we were taught in college was do not measure the resistance of a wall outlet. And somebody tried to do it and smoked his meter.
Burn up the class's meter?
Or is no, his. That was one of our projects. Our instructor bought some voltmeter or multimeter kits, and we built them in class one section at a time to understand how each part of it worked. And, you know, it was fun. And it's a good little meter.
Seems pretty interesting.
I had it for a lot
Still
of years.
Got it?
I don't have it anymore. I've forgotten what I did to it. Something unfriendly, though, I'm sure.
Probably trying to measure some voltage using the resistance setting.
It could have been. Or either let a battery eat it up or measure.
Sounds more likely.
On the wrong scale and burn a resistor in it. I do remember I burned a resistor in it one time. And I actually had to use some resistance wire to wind another one on a form to get it exactly the resistance it needed to be to work in that circuit of the meter. But then you add a little inductance when you do that. So not the best solution, but it's what we could do.
Which of the following measurements are made using a multimeter? A, signal strength and noise.
B, impedance and reactance.
C, voltage and resistance.
And D, all of these choices are correct. Which of the following measurements are made using a multimeter? Well, I would like to have a meter that I could say all of these choices are correct about.
Wouldn't that be nice?
There's not one. A multimeter, that means it's going to measure more than one thing, but signal strength and noise, that you wouldn't call that a multimeter. Impedance and reactance, can't measure that with a multimeter. Voltage and resistance, yeah, you can measure those too. You can usually measure current as well, but it's not a choice there. I'm going to say C, voltage and resistance.
That's the most common one, isn't it?
Yep. That was a little mixture in the chat room there, but I think everybody ended up agreeing it is C, and it is. Which of the following types of solder should not be used for radio and electronic applications? A, acid core solder.
B, lead tin solder.
C, rosin core solder.
Or D, tin copper solder. I've never seen tin copper solder before, but it may be around. I know rosin core is okay, and I know lead tin's okay because that's usually with the metal that they're made out of. So I'm going to go with A, acid core solder. Acid just seems like a bad idea when you're going to put it on some copper components and stuff like that. It seems like that acid could eat things away.
You know, it does sound like accident waiting to happen, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. Just don't seem like a good idea. I don't even know why they would make acid core solder.
Well, there's a reason, but it's not electronics. Everybody's saying A. Absolutely guaranteed avoiding your heat kit warranty. Yeah. Acid core solder. Or solder. Somebody pronounces it solder, I'm sure. Yeah, it's
folks
good.
Over the pond, it's don't good. Like it when we just call it solder.
Acid core is good for plumbing, as Tom mentioned. And yeah, if you've got something big like that, using that acid core flux will help it solder easier or faster or better for that application. But it's going to lead to corrosion. If you look at any copper plumbing in a house, and you got that green stuff on it, that's where it came from.
Yeah. I've done a lot of plumbing before with copper, but I always use solid core solder and used the flux in a little tin. Looks like a little snuff tin in a brush. But I don't remember it being acid, but that's been a long time ago.
It is. The stuff you buy at Lowe's, that's...
There was no such thing as Lowe's when I was doing that.
Well...
But at the plumbing supply, Southern Pipe, but...
Yeah, it's... I'm pretty sure it'd be acid core. Don't know
that. Acid in the tube. The solder didn't have a core in it. It was just solid core.
Yeah.
What is the characteristic appearance of a cold tin lead solder joint? A, dark black spots.
B, a bright and shiny surface.
C, a rough or lumpy surface.
Or D, excessive solder. What is the characteristic appearance of a cold tin lead solder joint? A, dark black spots. B, bright and shiny surface. Now, if it was good, it would have a bright, shiny surface if it's tin lead solder. C, a rough and lumpy surface. That's not good. Or D, excessive solder. Yeah, you could have excessive solder, and that wouldn't be what you would desire on the connection, but it doesn't actually mean that it's a cold solder joint. I'm going to say C, a rough and lumpy surface. And, yeah, it's not bright and shiny. Used to, we would say it was dull-looking. But that's not a choice there. So, chat room, we're saying C. And Caps Lock says, yeah, I think they have medicine for that now. Rough and lumpy surface. I hope they do. And I notice they said tin lead solder because... Europe and a lot of the world, and here in the U.S. too, they are using solder that doesn't have lead in it anymore, lead-free solder. That is one of my least favorite solders. It doesn't do as good a job, in my opinion. It takes a lot more heat, and it looks kind of, it doesn't look nice and bright and shiny like tin lead solder.
So what's the other metal?
I don't know because I don't have any of it anymore. I don't like it, so I'm not sure. what's in there, but it's not lead. It's
but you can still buy lead ones with lead in it?
In the U.S., you can't. In Europe, you can't. I don't think you can buy equipment in Europe that was manufactured using lead solder. Yeah, it looks like the chat room is not, oh, silver. Is it silver in them? In it, I know there is silver solder, but I didn't know that's what they had were using as lead-free solder these days.
Oh, no. I've done a lot of silver solder with the for air conditioning.
It's good stuff for bigger jobs like that.
Mm-hmm. Takes a pretty good torch to melt it.
Yeah. Just a little tech note here. You'll never run across this, anyone in the chat room, unless you buy an old piece of Tektronix test equipment. And I don't know if the consumer test equipment had it, but most of the broadcast equipment, and I'm sure Tom knows what I'm going to say here, with a background in television, a lot of the waveform monitors that we use were Tektronix tube types. And they used a special solder in there because, and I'm not sure if it was silver solder. I think it was, but it may not have been. But inside the scope, there would be a little plastic spool that had some of that special solder wrapped on it. And it was inside the unit there so that if you had to work on it and resolder a connection, you had some of the right type of solder to repair it with.
Huh.
They used little strips in there. It was like, because it didn't use PC boards, it was like little ceramic strips that had notches cut out and silver plating or something like silver plating in them and the notches, and you'd lay the components across there and then solder to that. And I guess that's why they had that special solder. Let's see. Tom says the most popular type is, and he's talking about lead-free solder, SAC-305 is 96.5% tin, 3% silver, 0.5% copper. Yeah, the old Tektronix had a roll of silver solder inside. And it melts at a lower temperature. And I have a little bit of that from a Tektronix scope in my old toolbox down here.
Yeah, Francis said he's got a roll in his junk box.
Yeah. I have some silver solder as well that I use for other things. I don't really use it for electronics so much, but that's good stuff.
I still got that same roll of organic core solder you gave me.
Yeah.
That's what I've been using. I've probably used about maybe half of it.
Yeah, the reason I gave that to you, and it was good solder, and I used that.
Because it stinks?
Well, yeah, it does stink, in it, but it will remove the hairs from your nose.
Well, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, without having to go in with the iron itself. But I use no clean flux solder now, and I've been using it for a number of years, and just so after you solder something, you don't have to clean the resin off if you don't want to.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I clean the flux off afterwards usually, but you don't have to.
Is that made by Kester?
Yeah, it's probably some other manufacturers that make it too. But it is definitely tin lead solder. Yep, that I use. What reading indicates that an ohmmeter is connected across a large discharged capacitor? A, an increasing resistance with time.
Ooh. B, decreasing resistance with time.
C, steady full scale reading.
Or D, alternating between open and short circuit. Ugh. What reading indicates that an ohmmeter is connected across a large discharge capacitor? Alternating between open and short circuit, that's not it. I don't think it's going to be a steady full-scale reading either. Decreasing resistance with time.
Well,
hold on. What?
I was going to suggest you want me to grab a meter and a capacitor and we'll find out.
If you got one handy, that'd be cool.
I do. Yeah. The old Simpson 260 M from Mirror.
Holy buddy goody.
Yep.
I got one of those.
So, and this is because when I started filming electronics, not too many of us had capacitance meters, but we needed some way to measure capacitor. We couldn't tell the value of the capacitor, but we could get an idea of maybe if it was bad or not. This is, what is this? 1,000 microfarads at 50 volts. So we'll put the ohm meter on. R times 1 is really too low. R times 1,000 is generally the scale that I like to use, but you don't got that on here. So we're going to use R times 100, and that with 1,000 microfarad, that's probably a high enough resistance. Let's just zero calibrate the meter here. We just turn the zero knob to put the pointer right on zero there. So when it's shorted out, that's 0 ohms. In doing that, you're taking into account the resistance that's in the leads as well, and the battery voltage that may have dropped in the meter. So what do you think? I got one lead connected. I'm going to connect the other one, and we'll see what happens on the meter. Did you see that?
Yep.
Now, if I touch it again, it's not going to do anything. I have to flip the capacitor over because what it's doing is it's charging the capacitor with the voltage that's on these probes here. All right. So looking at that, what would you say the answer is? What just happened?
I would say that so ohm meter. There's going to be resistance is going to decrease with time.
Think about it pretty hard.
Oh, I guess it's going to be increasing resistance with time. Hey.
Yeah, if we looked at the scale over zero,
yeah,
is right here.
Yeah.
And that's why I said it's kind of tricky because that meter reads backwards of, you know, of what you would normally see a voltmeter. The higher the reading, the higher the voltage. It's right the opposite on an ohm meter.
Right.
So, yeah.
Going with A, increasing resistance with time.
Yep. Tom said B for buzzer. We gave him a we gave him a second shot there.
I can claim the buzzer. It don't matter.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking about it the right way at first. It happens.
If you were looking at it on a digital meter, then you'd just see digits, and you would actually see the number get bigger. The number would increase. But when you're looking at an old analog meter, you have to reverse your thinking when you're on the ohm scale. So I figured that's probably tripped up a lot of people. But not many folks have the privilege of owning an analog meter anymore.
Yeah, I don't even know if you can hardly buy them. You probably can, but I don't know that they're very prevalent.
I do occasionally see them. I think maybe Harbor Freight had them. I have seen some, but only cheap ones these days. You don't see any, you know, good high quality ones. It's usually the real cheap meters. And you still need one of those. Just for
one of the little yellow $5 ones.
Yep. Just
special.
For that particular reason right there, it's kind of hard to do the capacitor test there on a digital meter. And the analog just responds in real time, where a digital meter is sampling, so, you know, it's not as smooth a transition on any of that stuff.
So what's that telling you, that the capacitor is good? It doesn't really measure the...
No, it doesn't.
Amount of capacitance.
But what that tells you, if you were trying to check this 1,000 microfarad capacitor and you had another 1,000 microfarad you knew was good, you could do that test with the known good one and see how the meter responded, and then do that test with the one you were suspicious of, and if it behaved the same, then you would know it was good.
Gotcha.
The higher value of capacitor, and I'd say, you know, more microfarads, the more swing you're going to get out of that meter. If we had just used 100 microfarad capacitor, it wouldn't have swung that high unless we stepped it up to like R times 10,000. But yeah, basically what you're looking for is the meter to swing up and come down and come all the way down. If the meter doesn't go all the way to infinity, then the capacitor is leaky. In other words, there's some internal resistance between the two plates in it. You can buy a brand new Simpson 260 from Granger for only $663. Wow.
Which of the following precautions should be taken when measuring in-circuit resistance with an ohmmeter? A, ensure that the applied voltages are correct.
B, ensure that the circuit is not powered.
C, ensure that the circuit is grounded.
Or D, ensure that the circuit is operating at the correct frequency. Which following precautions should be taken when measuring in-circuit resistance with an ohmmeter? Well, the frequency's got nothing to do with measuring resistance. With an ohmmeter. C, ensuring the circuit is grounded. No, it doesn't have to be grounded. A, ensure that the applied voltages are correct. You do not want voltage on a circuit when you're measuring resistance. I think we talked about that earlier. B, ensure that the circuit is not powered. I'm going to say B. What do you think?
Oh, I definitely think it's B. You're going to smoke your meter if it is.
Yep. Everybody in the chat room thinks it's B, too. So it is. Francis also says he bought Simpson years ago. He thinks it was $500 at the time.
Yeah, when I was talking about that rosin core solder or organic core solder, I've got asking you about what you have. If it was Kester, I thought about ordering some, but that'd still be kind of crazy because. I've still got all that other. I'd probably never use that for the rest of my life.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You probably still got 20 years worth left on that spool.
Yeah, more than I'm going to live, probably. I don't know if I'll make it 20 more.
You just need
that'd make me 83. I don't know if I'll be around that long.
You just need to do more soldering. That's what I just heard.
It is.
Yeah.
Now that I'm kind of retired, I guess I should be able to find some more time to tinker around with some of that stuff, I hope.
Yeah.
Got a few little projects over here I want to do anyways.
Francis said he got another Simpson at Huntsville for $50. A Series 4, oldie but goodie.
How do you know what series they are?
It says...
it's on the front?
Yeah, like right here. Mine is Series 7M.
Let me go get mine and see what it is. We'll compare. Right.
The M means it's a mirrored scale. You can see that mirror there. And what that does is eliminates parallax error. So wherever the meter falls, you move your eyeball in front of it to where the reflection of the pointer lines up with what you're looking at, because if you're off to the side, you know, you'll have a little error.
Mine's in the leather case.
Yeah, see, I don't have a case, man.
Oops.
I had one at work at an old job in a roll top case, but that just makes
Series
it
six.
Bigger.
leads and all. Anyway, it's not the one with the little mirror behind the back of it like yours.
Yeah, what series?
Six.
Six. Okay. So it was a series right before this one, and I guarantee you, it looks virtually the same on the front as far as your ranges and all of that. The thing that is, so are your probes male or female? No, the other end, not the business end.
Well, that is both ends. Oh, you can't see it behind the table.
Yeah, is that a male or a female that plugs into the meter? It's a male. This one, and I don't know if this was all Series 7s were this way, this is a female, which means it is very hard to find probes that fit this one.
Yeah.
Because the male is down inside the hole there. Down in there. But somebody told us about these things, and I bought a set of them. They were more than they should be. Yeah. It's got a female on each end, so you can just plug them down in the hole, and then you can plug your regular male probes into it. They were more money than they should have been, but, hey, solved the problem, because if you don't have probes for the thing, it's not really any good to you.
Yeah. I was thinking maybe these weren't the original probes, but they do say Simpson on them.
Yeah.
Have
you ever seen the any probes that had like the old metal El Cheapo phonograph stylus in them? Do you remember the kids' record players that had the little sharp needle?
Yeah, I remember the record players.
Well, I have a set of probes over here that's what you use for the tips. I've put a piece of heat shrink. That's a little knurled metal nut there, and you see that little sharp pointed probe on it?
Yeah, it's not focusing real good, but I can see. There we go. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that unscrews, and this pulls out. I mean, it's sharp as a pin, man. If you drop that thing on your foot, it will poke a hole in it. Ask me how I know.
Oh, it might be like the Simpson. The Simpson one, these unscrew. Where is it? There. Those unscrew.
Yeah, the alligator clips.
Yeah, then you got this.
Yeah, and that's the way mine is. Mine is. The ones I've got are like what you've got. There's threaded, and you can screw those alligator clips that have the threads in them on it. And I've got a set of those like you've got there. They're handy to have. George was talking about the probes that have replaceable tips that look like old 78 record player needles. I think that's what they were. I mean, they look identical. Speaking of wardrobe, have you had any thoughts on that while we were sitting here tonight, other than the Ham Crew t-shirt you presented?
Well, yeah, actually I do. If people aren't sending the entry for the Ham Crew t-shirt, if you didn't get your name drawn this time, send your entry in for next month for sure. But if you're in a hurry, don't want to wait till next month, you can get you some other swag, some Amateur Logic and Ham College swag at shop.spreadshirt.com/amateurlogic. You can get coffee mugs, caps, golf type shirts, t-shirts, hoodies. There's backpacks on there, all kind of things. There's more than just shirts, cups. So go check it out. shop.spreadshirt.com/amateurlogic.
Yep.
Be one of the cool kids.
And if you want to know what's going on, when the next Ham College is going to be, there's a place you can do that, and that's in the Amateur Logic High Society, where you can
Facebook.com.
Yeah.
/groups/Ham College.
You can follow us on Ham College at Twitter or X.
We also have a groups.io list, groups.io/g/amateurlogic. That's handles all the amateur logic and ham college traffic through there. So
yep.
If you're not a social media person, that's a good one for you.
Yep. And if you want show notes to know what we talked about in any particular episode, well, you can find that for you.
You want show notes? Mm-hmm. We have show notes at amateurlogic.tv/wiki. I happen to know the guy that keeps those up, and they're definitely there. There are notes.
Okay. I think that's going to do it for tonight's show. We appreciate everyone who joined us on the live stream and everyone who's watching afterwards on the recorded version. Next Ham College, well, I don't know what the date is going to be. There'll be two of them coming up in March, though. You're going to be out of the country for a little while.
From the 7th to the 15th.
Okay. All right. Well, then I don't know when the next one will be. It'll be soon, though, because we got to get two in next month. So
yeah, we could always do it one. Well, we can talk about it offline.
Yeah. But if you want to know, right there, follow one of those places, you can find out when the next one will be.
You'll know when we know.
Yep. All right. Next, Amateur Logic. Tommy won't be with us because he'll be out of the States. But that will be, and we couldn't miss a Friday the 13th. You know, that's just kind of a traditional show date for Amateur Logic. So there's two Friday 13ths in a row this year.
I think that's somebody's birthday too, isn't it?
It's my birthday.
That's what I thought. Might be somebody's coming up.
Yep. So it'll be a birthday bash.
Be sure to wear your hockey mask. Yeah,
I might have to get a Mountain Dew or something to drink. I don't know.
There you go.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for being here, everybody. And we really appreciate it. Join us again on the next episode. And study.
Yep. Spread the word. And get your entry in for those t-shirts for the next swag giveaway for next time. Yep. Anyway, so 73, everybody. Appreciate y'all being here.
73. As if that wasn't enough, we covered symptoms,